Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and I'm so excited about today's program.
Why are you excited? You're always excited about today's program.
I know, but, you know, because we do the interviews, and I'm pleased with the people, and I'm glad to share it with our audience.
And isn't it flavorful Sunday today?
Is that what it's called?
I think that's what I put at the top of the page here. It says flavor, yes. Different kinds of flavor. So we have a barbecue flavor man. We have a flavor man. We have a foraging for flavor person. I can't remember whether that's a man or a woman.
It's a woman.
And then we have pickles. Pickles that started out as side dishes in a restaurant and became a business in their own right. So that's what's ahead of us today. And starting out, we have...
And we're going to try to visit them at some point.
Yeah, yes, we are. Okay. And anyway, we have the famous or infamous or whatever I like to call them, the king of barbecue books, Adam Perry Lang.
Which is probably the most original barbecue book we've ever seen. Now, this time of the year, we generally do more than our share of barbecue books. There's a new one out called Charred and Scruffed by Adam Perry Lang that I would say totally reshuffles the deck in the whole game of barbecuing. Adam Perry Lang, you've really produced a game changer, haven't you?
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. For me, I think that there's wonderful books out there. This book is really different. For me, it's technique-based. It clearly, it does have lots of recipes, but it's really based around different techniques for you to improve upon your barbecue, and a lot of it, given moments in time, really changes up what is the industry's standard, whether it's grill marks, and I'm kind of anti-grill marks on grilling in general, and just how you're handling things. I describe it almost as a dialogue in heat, how you have to really respond and react to what's going on.
Yeah, you love fire.
I love it, yes.
Well, now, let's for those listeners who've been hiding under a stone and really don't know what's going on, Adam Perry Lang is frequently described as the king of barbecue. And his first book, 25 Recipes for Barbecuing, is our son's absolute Bible.
Yeah, BBQ 25, that's correct.
He absolutely adores that. Adam Perry Lang took the world by storm in partnership with the famous Jamie Oliver with a restaurant in the City of London called Barbacoa, which is still going strong. We're delighted to hear.
But don't forget he's a classically trained chef.
Well, I'm not sure I actually knew that, but I'm sure that that's got something to do with the fact.
Yeah, I started at Le Cirque. Was one of my first restaurants, and then I went on to a fantastic restaurant, Chanterelle, and actually I worked in France for some time.
You dedicate this book to Daniel Boulou.
Yeah, tremendous mentor, tremendous friend, really an inspiration. It was a big deal for me to do that.
I love him.
Isn't he just, we were just in New York a few weeks ago, and we went to Boulou Sud for the first time.
He's amazing.
And it's really, the more amazing thing is that the chef there is a native of the same part of England as I am. He's a Yorkshireman, although from a different part of the county.
Excellent.
And cooking quite beautifully.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Well, let's get back. I know that you, on your own, experimented with everything having to do with cooking, with fire and so forth. But how did you develop these really revolutionary, or at least let's call them innovative techniques for approaching rest?
I think it's just, these things come out of repetition, and I just cooked so much with fire and meat, and I think that out of that comes this kind of natural gravitation toward movement of your hands or just understanding what works and what doesn't. And it really just comes out of intense experience. And then turn around and try to make it palpable to people that don't get to cook as much but can really just grab from my experience and be able to improve upon their things. Some people might find it intimidating. Some people completely do not. But even those that might find some of the techniques or recipes intimidating, even if you grab just one technique from it, your barbecue or your grilling will improve 100%. And I really mean that because I really look to piggyback flavors on top of flavors, movements. And aside from improving your barbecue, actually, you look really good doing it because there's ways of moving and doing things that help you master the grill.
Now, you said a few minutes ago that you don't believe in grill marks, but you nevertheless believe in charring things.
Yeah, well, grill marks, the way I look at it, it shouldn't be the thing that is strive for. If they happen, they happen. But I'm interested in browning and flavor. And browning's different than caramelizing. Browning is this Maillard reaction. It elicits this response, this flavor response that we have. And it's evident, unless you're on a diet, no if you're asked to choose between a boiled piece of meat and a roasted or a charred piece of meat, you're always going to choose the charred or roasted piece of meat. And there's something innate in it drives us all towards that. When I talk about scruffing, I'm really talking about increasing surface area so that you get a maximum amount of this flavor that is coming from the meat.
Now, what is scruffing?
Scruffing, you know, I really try to take a look at when people say, hey, this is real home cooking as opposed to restaurant cooking, and people would always favor this home cook type of experience. I try to take a look at it, and I'll go back to an experience with my grandmother when cooking a brisket and putting it to the pan and the heat and it's sticking and ripping it off the pan and it's tearing and creating all these nooks and crannies, and you think that she's destroying it, in reality, it ends up just intensifying and increasing the flavor of the sauce, and there's a lesson to be learned in that, as opposed to doing something so perfectly cut and almost sterile in nature, which is very pretty to look at, and it's nice, but how do we maximize the flavor? And that's one of the inspirations behind it.
Now, as I read the book, you really attribute the word scruffing to your partner, Jamie Oliver, and he was doing something with sort of knocking the potatoes around a little bit.
We were hanging out once, and something I kind of came across before, but I never really saw it done with potatoes, and he's rattling them around in the colander, and he's saying he's kind of like roughing them up a bit, and I was like, why would you do that? And then he was just talking about the crispy bits, and I was like, oh, you know, that's clever. And for me, I really just took it and I applied it to food, you know, to meat in general, which I was doing already, but it just resonated by looking at that, because, of course, those are the tiny bits that I used to fight for with my sister, you know, over. So it made sense. How sometimes things just develop.
Now, hold on just a second again. Adam, but you go beyond that. So we sort of know about basting, and we know about marinating, and we know about mopping with sauce, but I never knew anything before about spackling that wasn't to do with home improvement. So perhaps you can explain how you sort of gone even further along.
Well, spackles are an answer just to, people like ketchup, mustard. I mean, these things all work, and I'm not trying to replace them, but I am trying to give alternatives. Sometimes you can do things that are even a greater punch, or you want to do something a little bit different. And the spackle is, which I also refer to as these fork finishers, is when you take these condiments and you almost dehydrate them slightly, intensifying the flavor. So, for example, I have a tomato spackle, which you can do in a dehydrator. If you really have a dehydrator, you can do it in a convection oven. You can just do it in the sun, in sun dry it. But you're taking almost like a puree, and you're dehydrating it slightly, whatever means that you choose to use. It gets to the consistency of a spackle that you would fix your wall. So, you know, when you're building things on a fork, which we do typically at barbecue and grilling type things, you're kind of adding a little bit of this and that. Because you put the American, you just put a little bit of this onto it, and it breaks things up, because typically with barbecue and grilled food, flavors can be numbingly intense, and you need a break in the action. And it usually comes in the form of acidity, it comes in the form of texture, or something that's palate cleansing, like a beer even. And so you need to mix up the whole thing to make it exciting, otherwise you're just killing yourself.
Now, you put things directly in the hot coals.
Yeah, that's a great technique. I call it clinching, and I came up with the concept of boxing. When you have a fighter with a long reach and you have one with a shorter reach, the one with the shorter reach is trying to get inside. And I figured out that it's actually cooler directly on the coals than 3 inches above it. And when the combustion is occurring at 3 inches above, these flames can really act like these punches from someone who has long reach. So by closing the gap, you can actually cook an inch and a half, inch and a quarter steak really quickly. I consider it almost like a steak microwave, because you put it directly on the coals. And bear in mind, this has to be lump charcoal. And I do it on the briquettes, which I do like for other things, really create a condition which can make the steak rather gritty. So by using a hairdryer, if you can, or just a fan, you kick off the ashes that's growing on top of the coals, and you throw the steak right on, which I call the dirty method, and as you turn it, you take this herb brush, which is this bundle of herbs, which I put on the back of a wooden kitchen spoon or whatever you have handy, and I gently swirl off the charcoal, which not only kicks off the little bits that might stick, but it also is the perfect time to add layers of flavor.
Most of these photographs of you in this book, you're surrounded by smoke, or you have great a tall, high licks of flames all around you. It looks like almost dangerous.
Well, it might seem that way, and that's why I wrote the book, because the whole concept of it is for people to feel unintimidated by working with these things. But flames happen, and people are constantly looking for an exact way to do a recipe or to do something, and they're really ignoring the fact that flames and cooking on a barbecue or a grill can be unruly. So let's really talk about what's going on instead of trying to break it down in 6 minutes on one side. Don't move the steak. That's why the theme of the book is really a dialogue with heat.
Yes.
What's going on? It's not going to be exact. Is it a very windy day? Is it a humid day? And I want to arm people with the types of tools that they would need to be adaptive. And that's what the book is about, Chardon's Prep. So it's more than just the title. It's also matching why we choose the size. Why would we choose heartwarming mashed potatoes with a steak one day, and then the next day, another time of year, you might pick an arugula salad with lemon and Parmesan. And they're both the same meat, but in effect, it's completely different. So I explore the other half of the book with why we choose the sides that we do.
Right. Well, maybe we should just go through a little bit of the categorizations here under the general title of act of barbecuing. But you're not like letting somebody throw a burger on the grill and walk away and have a beer, right?
No, you can't do it. You just never know how the flame's going to react, the fat content. One friend of mine was cooking steaks, and he was so proud that he had these super prime steaks, and he tried to handle it like he would a steak with less fat. The fat was just weeping into the fire, and it just incinerated it. So I work with these different techniques where you're moving it around, and you're kind of getting to know what the meat is going to do, and you need to move it around. I call the technique a hot potato technique, and it's a way of, you hold the hot potato, you keep switching it from one side to the next, one hand to the next. Well, it's the same with steak. You're going to temper the steak, and you're going to, the movement of heat be more even with the steak when you're using that technique.
There's absolutely no question.
That's revolutionary.
Yeah, if there was an Old Testament that was the way you used to barbecue, and then this is the New Testament to barbecue in accordance with Adam Perry Lang. Saint Adam Perry Lang, maybe we'll get to call you soon. But listeners, you have to understand, this is such a beautiful man, in addition to being a great chef.
No, thank you.
And a great cookbook writer, because he will take the time to answer inquiries from barbecue chefs of all levels all across the country. We know, because our son relies on him. And you too can get in touch with him. How do people do that, Adam?
You can get in touch with me on my website at adamperrylang.com, and you can email me directly, and I'll get back in touch with you.
And he really does. And so you can probably do it from your iPhone or your iPad while the meat's on the fire, but...
Even Twitter, you know. Well, first try to get in touch with me first, because once it's on the fire, things are happening.
That's the
whole point, right?
So the book is called Charred and Scruffed.
Bold New Techniques for Explosive Flavor on and off the grill. And I must say this, though, Adam, I'd like to come to your house for barbecue.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome to. Thank you both for taking the time to interview me and give me your support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, the other thing you can do, now, before we sign off, let's be sure that people understand. If they're traveling to London, they can enjoy your restaurant, Barbacoa, which is found at what website?
At barbacoa.com, B-A-R-B-E-C-O-A.
Thank you so much for joining us today, and okay. We'll probably see you in London next year.
Okay, fantastic.
It's the freshest book I've ever seen on barbecue.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye, Adam.
Take care, both of you.
And don't go away, because we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, we are indeed back, and we're going to be introducing you to one handsome young man who has great flavor ideas and will inspire you to be a flavor seeker. It's Angelo Sosa.
I don't know what I could say about Angelo Sosa. I'm just absolutely fascinated by your book, Flavor Exposed, and by your philosophy of just go for it, which is something that's really hard to do unless you're absolutely a master as you are, because everything you go for is pretty much right on. Background, Angelo.
Well, first and foremost, thank you, Anne, for having me on. I'm very excited. So I'm just regardless of the fact that I live in New York City, I'm just this country kid. Grew up in a big family in Connecticut, a small town called Durham. Remember getting fresh milk delivered to the door, fresh ice cream. I actually think we have one of the best soft-serve ice cream places in the country, made from fresh cow's milk, and the flavor is just so incredible. Grew up in a very big family. There's 9 of us total. I have six siblings, 5 girls. There was 2 boys. My father is Dominican. My mother's Italian. And my father was always, father comes back from a military background, and he was always about providing for the family. So my big tasks and my chores were probably a little bit different from other kids' chores. I had to work in the garden. I had to weed the garden. I had to till the garden. I had to cook on the weekends. I was my father's little sous chef on Saturdays in preparation for our big Sunday meal.
Oh, wow.
Which was quite pretty extravagant. So I think definitely cooking is in my blood. I'm somebody who's very passionate about life, passionate about cooking, passionate about leaving impressions in people. And I think that true passion came from, and I speak about her in my sweet chapter in my book, my Aunt Carmen. My Aunt Carmen passed away about 20 years ago, and she was the most beautiful person inside and out, and probably the best chef, better than any other chef I've ever worked for. Remember, we would drive in to Queens, whole family, all 9 of us, pack up the car, and we got to her house. My parents would open the door, and I remember all my brothers and sisters just running through the house and screaming and running past the kids, running outside to go play, and I literally would do the same, but I would run to the kitchen to watch my Aunt Carmen cook.
And was she Dominican?
She was Dominican, and these aromas, what was fascinating, and I knew then at this point in time it was in my blood, because the aromas and the passion in the air would literally draw me to the kitchen, and I would sit there for hours and just watch her. And what was more impressive was when it was time to eat, just imagine this spread, the table.
Oh, yes.
My aunt would sit at the head of the table, and I would literally just sit by her side like a little dog, just in awe of her presence and her love and her passion. And what was much more impressive than all of that was she would always be the last one to eat, because she found more pleasure in serving people. And I think that just really enamored me and made me more passionate person and more passionate chef than ever.
Now, then you went sort of somewhat more conventional. So you decided, obviously, you knew about cooking, so you knew you wanted to be one. So then you said, okay, well, I'm going to go to the CIA.
Correct.
Almost too conventional, but then you tell the story in the book about how you wanted to meet the boss.
That is true. Cooking went from me being, so passionate that it became an obsession. Like, I wanted to be the best. I wanted to do whatever it took to be the best. And that being said is when I went to the Culinary Institute of America. Within the first week, I remember this young little naive kid, very energetic, walking up to the president's office, meeting his assistant and saying, I'm Angelo Sosa and I need to speak to President Metz. And they're like, who? So basically, I hounded them so much that eventually they gave in, and I had a meeting with the president at his house, and I went the day of the meeting. I went, I dressed up, tie, and looked as dapper as possible. And getting to his house, I literally just walked up to him. I introduced myself. I said, my name is Angelo Sosa, and I just said, I want you to remember this name because I'm going to be one of the greatest chefs in America. And I just walked right out.
Is that what you said? Oh, my.
So retrospect, obviously, I was very naive and very bold and very passionate person and very passionate chef, and just wanting to be like President Metz, and really quite funny.
Oh, and him, I think it is very funny.
Now, you're somewhere along the way, not too many steps along, you hooked up with Jean-Georges Vongerichten?
Yes, Jean-Georges, who is I attribute my love and passion for Asian cuisine, and really just showing me the flavors of the Southeast Asia. I worked with him almost a total of 4 years. As I said, he inspired me to travel throughout Asia, learn the vibrancy of the flavors, and expose myself to all these global and amazing flavors.
Now, how did Iron Chef fit into this?
What, Top Chef?
I mean, Top Chef. Not Iron Chef. Top Chef.
Top Chef came into the picture about, I think, going on 2.5 years ago. I was on back-to-back seasons. I did season 7 DC and the All-Stars. Definitely my experience on season 7 was very different than the All-Stars. Season 7, I definitely felt like a sniper. I was definitely on a mission. I had definitely 2 different objectives. And for the All-Stars, I think it was just me just wanting to have fun, wanting to learn, and wanting to explore and learn from the other chefs.
The forward to your book is by Alain Ducasse, and your talent just kind of blew him away, right?
Yes, Alain Ducasse, not only is he's my mentor, I really look at him as a father figure in my life. He really, in a time of, I speak about a bitter part of my life in the book of something that I learned, and literally when I thought that I was at the lowest of all lows, next thing you know, a famous French chef with the most Michelin stars in the world comes and like swoops me away and brings me to a place of aligning myself with my passions again, which is, I attribute him to a lot of my success.
It's really curious because he doesn't really seem a lot like a father figure. It makes it all the more remarkable that he recognizes your talent.
And it really makes me appreciate him even more. He's such a humble and gracious man and very, very genuine, and I'm just honored that I'm in his life and that he's in my life.
Now, here's the next sort of stepping point we need to make, because you write in your book about the fact that you were just about to, I think, go home one evening when Alain Ducasse walked in, somebody said he just walked into the restaurant, and you decided you better stay and cook for him. But no.
I think that was a smart idea, yes.
But no, let me reach my point, because I don't know exactly the style of cooking you were doing at Yumcha at the time, but the recipes in this book don't really seem to me to be like the kinds of things that Alain Ducasse would be very comfortable with, if you pardon me saying so.
Well, I think that's the point, and I think that's, from what I've heard from Mr. Ducasse, I think that's something that stood out in his head, because he felt like the flavors were very unorthodox and unexpected and very surprising. And yeah, I remember going back some time, I think it was about 2000, the only hours of the day that I understood was going to work at 6 a.m. and leaving work at 2 a.m. And I think for 3 months, this was my life. And after 3 months, after working 7 days a week for the last 3 months, I wanted to take a day off, or at least a half a day off. And I remember going in for a half a day and anticipating getting some sleep at night. And as soon as I'm leaving, next thing I know, I'm looking up, and my sous chef is nudging me, saying that isn't that Alain Ducasse? And I'm like, he would never come to a restaurant here in the West Village. And little did I know, it was Alain Ducasse. And my jaw just dropped, and I was just in awe of his presence.
Well, he's certainly awe-inspiring, isn't he?
But your style of cooking, as illustrated in this book, is very different than you would get from an Alain Ducasse establishment.
Yeah, very, very, very true. You know, Alain Ducasse, his style is rooted in French classic. He has restaurants all over the world, but more, I would say, definitely more French classics in tradition. And my style is a very global style, where I not only fuse flavors, but I also fuse technique. So it isn't very traditional. It's much, much more unorthodox.
And Ducasse, though, pinpoints it pretty well. And doing the things you do, if you weren't so talented and if you weren't so expert in technique, in lesser hands, it could get just wild and chaotic. But in your hands, because you have all the abilities and all the talents and all the perception and all the passion, these things come through, even though they're not his style of cooking.
Thank you very much.
But look back, you organized this also in kind of an unorthodox way. How did you organize this book and explain why this is just a starter, that you're going to do more?
The premise of the book is for the home cook. It's picture driven. This also, there's 9 chapters. Within each of the chapters, a short story of my life that made me the chef that I am today. There's a sweet chapter that's about my aunt Carmen. There's a chapter called Umami, which is about my mommy. And, you know, I remember going to school with my Dukes of Hazzard lunchbox and being so anticipated to opening my lunch and so excited. Everybody's eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or hot dogs, and I open it up, and unbeknownst to me, I see pickles, pig's feet, cow's tongue sandwich, and obviously nobody wants, everybody's looking at me like I'm in, it's an Alfred Hitchcock movie, and nobody wants to trade lunches with me. But little did I know, that was teaching me about flavors of the world and having an open mind and learning how to be creative and putting flavors together. Yeah, and I think there's even the chapter, the bitter chapter of Yumcha, which I had, which was an amazing experience, but in the end, it ended up having a falling out with my partner, and the restaurant ended up closing. But the moral of the stories and chapters are things that I took out of it. And I think as successes are great to share, I think through failure, they're just as important to share those stories, because they define who you are, and they are, as long as you learn and you grow from them, I think they're very important to share.
Well, some of these recipes I read and they just make perfect sense. Others I read and I can't even imagine what would make you think of putting these things together. I imagine they probably all work. Have you ever had anything that didn't?
Oh, of course. And that's how these recipes came to fruition.
Okay.
You know, I'm a firm believer of risk being daring. I'm a firm believer of experimenting with with flavors. And I'm somebody who, even at a very young age, I'll put peanut butter and fish in my mouth. And the point is it's not does it taste good. The point is, what does it taste like? So I'd rather, as opposed to close my mind, I'd rather open my mind to new ideas and new flavors. And a great example of a recipe in the book is the scallop and banana. Like, who would want to put scallop and banana?
Oh, I saw that. I did see that.
But one, not only is it the easiest recipe, but it's the most exciting recipe, because it only makes sense because scallops are naturally sweet, especially if they're super, super fresh. But the banana, not only is the creaminess, but it accentuates that sweetness. And that cut with a little jalapeno or a little lemon juice, it is just, it's like being sent to a culinary heaven. It's really an epiphany of an experience.
Yeah, and you're just touching on this, your trinity concept of flavors. Explain that, because I think you just did kind of without pointing out that that's what you're doing.
Great example. You know, in Asian culture, Asian cuisine, you have, I believe a lot of people could relate to this, sweet, sour, salty, right? I believe in any of my dishes, there's always, and it's not always sweet, sour, salty, it could be something that's sweet, spicy, nutty. It could be something that's earthy, spicy, sweet. So within any dish, there's always a trinity of flavors that come together. And I spent a lot of time in my life understanding which trinity is like a sweet, sour, salty, that epiphany of an experience.
Now, are you putting those together in a single, on a single plate presentation?
Yep, exactly. So whether it's French fries, whether it's onion rings, whether it's scallop and banana, there will always be a trinity of flavors. Correct.
Okay, Michael Minna was doing that, wasn't he, at one time?
Yeah, doing three variations.
Three
on,
variations,
on
yeah.
An ingredient.
And it was all on the same plate.
Angelo's doing something different. He's putting all these elements into the rest. Like, for example, a perfect example is oysters with pineapple and seaweed mignonette. Mm. Now, that's a textbook explanation of your trinity, isn't it?
100%, because I'm taking something so simple that everybody, a lot of people have eaten oysters and mignonette, but I'm trying to jazz it up, adding some pineapple, adding some sweetness, having that balance with the sourness of the or the acidity of the vinegar, and accentuate the sweetness of the shallots with also balance with the brininess of the oyster. I think it's just a magical combination.
Now, you said that basically these nine elements, that's the start of what you're going to do. You really have 25 different flavor zones. Is that what I could call them?
As I explained it before, the nine flavors are what I call like the five mother sauces. Like, these are the core flavor profiles, and then I believe that there's actually 25 in total. I didn't want to, you know, I think this is a great premise, a great foundation for people to understand and grasp. And then I think definitely, hopefully, in the next book, I could explain that a little bit more in detail.
Have you talked to anybody who's cooked from this book?
I feel really blessed that I've been receiving responses from Facebook, on Twitter, that people have been very moved by the stories and the recipes. Like, people send me pictures of the dishes that they've cooked, and it's just very exciting for me. And it's I will be honest, it's very hard still for me to understand that I did create a book, just a small town country kid. I just never thought that this would ever be my life, so.
Oh, this is, I mean, it's incredible, this cookbook. I mean, it's very challenging in a way for your taste buds, not just because you're a home cook, but you just have to think outside the box, which is what you do, huh?
It is, but if you really break it down, like, there are flavor profiles that, the flavor profiles in themselves people could comprehend, but maybe the ingredient is a little bit different. A great example, once again, is that scallop and banana, or even there's a tuna kebab with feta cheese, like tuna and cheese. Like, the cheese just takes on a creaminess, a buttery aspect, but also a salt component. So instead of adding salt to the tuna, why not just break it up and do it in the form of the cheese?
Well, I really think this book has to be experienced by our listeners to, and then, you know, some of them are kind of very, almost traditional, like your buckwheat noodles with spiced cashew dressing, don't you think?
And how?
I mean, I just think that they're almost classics, some of these, and they're no stretch at all for the, you could just picture the buckwheat noodles with spiced cashew dressing as being yum, yum, yum.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's the premise of the book, is I believe in what's called the why factor. Every dish has to be yummy. If it's not yummy, I'm not going to make it. And the spiced cashew, they're all approachable, from the oysters to the mignonette, just jazzing up with a little pineapple or that buckwheat needle noodle. As opposed to a sesame dressing, why not just add a cashew? You know, you put a plate of cashews in a bowl for me, like, I'll finish it in a second. It's kind of like equivalent to pistachios. So they're just like very familiar dishes. I think there's an onion ring with a togarashi salt. Like, we just want to jazz it up and spice people's lives up.
Well, I think it's very exciting, and I'm glad you're excited about getting your reactions to it. And I just wish you the greatest success with this. And where are you cooking now?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, thank you so much. It's a big honor to one, create a book, but two, to be able to tell my stories and for you to appreciate them. So thank you very much. I am cooking in New New York City. I have two restaurants. One is on the east side, 53rd, between 2nd and 3rd, called Social Eats. It's an Asian gastropub. And then I have one on the west side, 47th and 10th, called Añejo, which is a tequileria and homestyle Mexican cooking.
Well, I'm putting that at the top of our list for next time we're in New York.
Excellent.
I can't wait to taste your food. And maybe I'll even try some of these recipes.
I would love for you to, and I would love for you to send me some pictures if you do.
Okay. Angelo, it's been a delight meeting you and talking to you.
Excellent. What an honor. Thank you so much for your time.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, well, here we are back again. And who's up next, sweetheart?
We're doing another continuation of the flavor theme. This one is called Foraged Flavor.
Foraged Flavor, yeah. It's somebody who goes and picks things for Danielle,
Swan,
right?
Yeah, and others, yeah, but another Danielle things. Boulou endorses.
She sure has a complicated story, but sounds like fun too. But I'm not sure I'm lining up to do it as my full-time job.
I do it.
Yeah, you do. You forage in our garden. She forages all over.
Yeah.
So you can forage all over too, and after you listen to her, you'll know more about what you're looking for too.
Well, we seem to be doing a lot with foragers and foraging these days. I think it's totally on trend, and I do this myself. But there's always something a little different that's offered with each book that comes out. We're going to be talking to Tama Matsuko Wong, who, with Eddie LaRue, who's the chef de cuisine at Danielle's in New York, Daniel Boulou's flagship restaurant. Tama wrote the book, and she's the forager. And I was just recollecting that an earlier book with Thomas Keller's Forager, we didn't interview the forager, we interviewed the chef. So we got a different perspective on this. But Tama, that was a long introduction. But anyhow, I wanted to mention too, before we launch into the book, Peter in particular loves these stories where you were a Wall Street trader, became a forager. I mean, we've interviewed chocolatiers who started out as criminal attorneys. So you had a long ways, and I enjoyed the little insights about how you started out foraging by carrying plastic trash bags full of herbs on the subway in New York, from New Jersey to New York.
Yes, on the PATH train.
Oh, funny. So what intrigued you about these plants? Why all of a sudden? I mean, you had a flourishing career doing something totally different. What was it that sparked your interest?
I mean, I guess I would say, and that it wasn't something that happened all at once. So it was sort of gradually something that was completely fascinating and rejuvenating. And that little bit of time I was spending on it ended up getting larger and larger.
So you just had more work than you could handle doing two jobs, I guess.
Yes, and I mean, I'm still doing some of my financial services work, but I do it in the off-season, the foraging off-season.
No, I mean, it's not just that you actually are taking up time foraging and supplying restaurants. You do a lot of education things as well, right?
Yes, and I would say that my primary interest in foraging was really to educate myself, because I wanted recipes and I wanted more information about when to pick things and how to pick them and how to prepare them. And a lot of what I'm doing now is trying to share that information with other people.
Yeah, no, this is a new twist on it, because I don't think that there's been another book that talks the way you do about the seasonality of what you're foraging. The book, by the way, is titled Foraged Flavor, and I think the second word is very essential to your approach to this. I mean, you don't want to just find edible weeds. You want to find things that taste good and that could be prepared
by
the chef.
Yeah, it is a good first step to know what it is. So, and with any type of food or vegetable, so, okay, first you want to learn that this is a cantaloupe and not a melon, but then you want to know that I'm going to cut the cantaloupe and maybe take the inside, scoop out the inside and eat it raw, as opposed to bake it in the oven.
Uh-huh.
So it's things like, you know, things like that. So once you know what the plant is, then what's the best time to pick it? When is it ripe or good? And then what's the best way to prepare it so it tastes good?
So you actually partnered, yes, the chef, Eddie LaRue, who's French by birth.
Yes, he is. Yes.
And of course, Daniel is a French restaurant in New York, and he got excited, too, about these flavors.
Yes.
And so we kept...
I don't think he could resist walking by without trying to eat something out of the bag.
How did you make that original connection? Were you a customer of Danielle, or did you just walk up one day with a snack?
It was really one of those random or fate things where you meet people. And I was eating in the restaurant at the request of friends. They had taken us to dinner there. I didn't know Danielle or Eddie, and they were really excited. I have at Meadow, and they're excited about the plants in the meadow, because I've been interested in plants for a long time. My background is really from my interest in plants. And they said, why don't you bring in something? You know, so they were sort of pushing me to bring something in, and since I was their guest, I thought, okay, why not? And I brought some things in to the receptionist. It was in summer, and they called down, and I guess they must have gotten Eddie LaRue, and they said he was familiar with it. It was Anise Hyssop, and that evening he and Dominique, the dessert chef, made two dishes for us, which were absolutely fantastic. And we went back to the kitchen to congratulate and thank them, and he was very interested. I had a little booklet about what my meadow looked like, so he could see, you know, that it was a good provenance and not polluted site. And he said, what else do you have? And I said, I have lots of stuff there. What are you looking for? And that's when he said, bring me everything. and I did. I'm a kind of, you know, I'm very passionate about these plants. So I did warn him and say, okay, but if you... People who know me know if you say to me, bring me everything, I will bring you. I will start bringing you things, you know, to try. And then, and he said, of course, you know, I ask you, of course I want you to bring. So that's how it initially started.
Now, you seem to me to be much more intellectual than most foragers. And let me go on and explain what I mean by that.
Some of our foraging friends are not going to like that.
Well, no, there's a guy.
Especially the one sitting next to you.
There's a guy up in Seattle. I mean, from talking to his book, you would think that he's recommending that you pick things out of the cracks in the sidewalk in New York City.
Oh, right.
Which didn't seem like a very appealing thing to do. not really sure that I would want to be there after the dogs have gone by. You have a really intellectual approach in that you even categorize your forage items into green, yellow, and red.
Yes.
Why don't you first of all talk a little bit about that?
Okay, so I mean, I guess to start back about, you know, my approach, I really wanted to get the information first. I didn't want to just, it's a new and exciting area for people, but I didn't want to just sort of jump in and already, I think I feel it's important to take the time to really understand what you're trying to do and then to come up with a conceptual framework about the way you want to approach foraging. I mean, for myself, that's what I did. So I have a framework about how I'm doing things and what I think to distinguish between what I think the is valuable for the public to do as opposed to what I might be bringing to the restaurant. I think there's a distinction there. And also the red, yellow, green coming from a plant and particularly plant ecology background, it's really the notion that you don't just go walk along and are just picking things here and there. All plants are not the same, and there's a big distinction between them in terms of their ecological place and relation to the landscape. And red, yellow, green was a very easy way, I thought, that people could understand, because I think they've seen that in seafood and other things. You can see it in the market about the sustainability of harvesting them. And I thought that was an easy way to get that point across. So while you could see some plants and they might be edible, it might not be great to pick them because they're very connected with the whole cycle of pollinators and wildlife and the soil. And so if you start picking them, then in the wild, they may not grow back because they're part of a very specialized landscape, whereas other plants are not that connected or they're even invasive and the government is trying to get rid of them. And so those, instead of some people say, just whatever plant it is, leave a little bit or something. Those plants you can take
every single one you see. Japanese knotweed.
Right. And a lot of these plants, speaking to a global audience, a lot of these plants, the reason they are invasive is because they're coming from another country.
Exactly.
And they don't have the same pests here. And in those other countries, their culinary, you know, people have been eating them for centuries, and some of them are even quite sought after. So it's really kind of interesting, and I think that makes a big difference, you know, conceptually, and provides a framework for people when they're, you know, trying to forage.
Now, there's one other thing I wanted to give you unusual credit for as well, because foraging, and especially foraging for mushrooms like morels, the last thing that a forager will tell somebody is where they actually get things from. And how to recognize them. That's the last thing you're going to find out from another forager. And you are 100% the opposite, because you have accurate descriptions and line drawings of all the plants that are in your book so that people can recognize them. And you explain the importance, of course, of that recognition. But by doing that, you're essentially inviting everyone to come and forage in the same way as you do. I guess you're just hoping they won't go to quite the same places.
Well, I think that I have a very different style. I have a lot of things. I have to do. Three daughters, husband, elderly parents. So I don't have a lot of time to go looking for secret places. And I think, I don't know, I think a lot of people are in the same boat as me. And there is this whole secret nature that, you know, some people think about foraging, which is, you know, they have these secret spots and that nobody wants to tell each other. So I wanted this to be more of, let's take the lid off the secret. Uh-huh. Of foraging and make it something that can be accessible to everybody. And they're things that you don't have to go 6 miles in the woods. But actually, they might taste as good or better than some of those things.
Yeah, now you, since Peter brought up the mushroom thing, you don't do a lot with the mushrooms. Why?
Okay, so definitely that was the things that we chose in the book were on purpose, both from sort of a plant perspective and also from an ID perspective. So a lot of the reasons that we don't choose a lot of mushrooms is because actually for the public, and we want people to really actually try and use this book. It's not just telling a story, although there are stories. So we wanted people to use it. And one of the more difficult things to start off with is mushrooms.
Yeah.
And if you get it wrong, you can die. It's serious, very serious. And even people who are mushroom experts in one part of the world and come here,
exactly,
and they see something that looks the same, it might not. I've heard of cases of that. So, and also it's not that accessible. It's not something that you just step out and it's growing in your foundation and your vegetable garden bed. So for those reasons, we have a couple in there, but we chose on purpose not to focus on
them. I mentioned that you divide up also by season, and there are reasons for this. In fact, there seem to be reasons for everything in your book. You're very rational.
Well, that's part of the framework, right? You need a framework, and then the things fall into place. And hopefully it helps, you know, the readers also to understand it, rather than just a compilation of various things in there. You know, it's sort of organized.
But it never occurred to me that there were stages of development where I knew this with dandelions because they get old and bitter. Mm-hmm. But I never would have thought about the optimum time to pick Queen Anne's lace.
Yes, and that also was part of our long involved project. So there were certain plants that they were maybe invasive plants, or I knew they'd been eaten someplace else. And so I was particularly focused on trying to get Eddie to try them. And he would keep saying no. Like, for one of example was Japanese barberry, which is a hugely invasive plant. But it has these great berries that are edible, and I was just thinking it just seemed like it would be so good. And whenever I kept bringing it in, he'd say it wasn't good. So I brought it in every 2 weeks for maybe 3 months. I was quite persistent. And then after the heavy frost, he was like, a light went off. He was like, it's good. So, you know, you could share that information with people now.
Yeah, well, you do. These are all chef-designed recipes. These aren't just like tossing in, like I do. I go and I pick purslane and toss it into the salad and wood sorrel and toss it into the salad. But these are developed recipes here. What are some of your favorite ones?
Well, I'm obviously thinking right now since we're in summer.
No, I mean, why is that an edible weed? I can't even grow this stuff.
We're kidding. In this area particularly, I would think Pennsylvania too, it's an emerging invasive plant.
Well, see, why can't I ever get any of it? I buy the seeds and nothing grows.
Well, maybe that's good, since... but it is so different than the shiso you can get in the supermarket because it's, you know, sort of flattened down and stiff. And when it's in the wild, then it's growing of its own accord. It escapes out of people's gardens. Then it has this really soft texture, and the flavor is twice as aromatic as you would get it in the supermarket. And it's also quite expensive in the supermarket.
It is expensive, I know. That's why I keep trying to grow, because I like it. Maybe I'm growing it and don't recognize it.
Maybe, because it comes up looking like kind of a weed when it first comes up.
Uh-huh. They all look like weeds.
They all look like...
Yes.
So anyhow, back to the recipes. What is something that you really like?
So right now we always like the phyllo, feta, and the amaranth recipes, because it's really easy to make a huge batch, freeze some, and then bring it around as like a little finger food, and you only need a couple of ingredients.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And you can substitute in pretty much amaranth or galansoga, which are also, all these are out around now, the summer, and they're really big in organic fields for farmers. So if you didn't have a backyard or someplace, you could probably go to your farmer and they would know.
Okay, so this book has so much detail in it, including color pictures as well as line drawings of all the different herbs, all these recipes. I think there are two more things that I want to say, other than saying thank you for this great piece of work that you're doing. One of those is your suggestion that it's really very easy for everyone with a garden to be able to get in on the foraging game, because you can create your own foraging field. And you say, take a 3-foot by 6-foot bed, a raised bed if you like, and then just leave it. Just leave it and see what lands.
Well, I throw dirt in it first.
Of course. It's a bed, so it has to be dirt.
Okay.
And you can have one, and then the neat part about it is it's very close to you, so that you don't have an excuse for not foraging. If things are growing in it, you obviously have to go look there, because it's probably only a few feet from your doorstep.
Yes.
So I think that's a great suggestion. Other thing that I think is vitally important, and that's the ability to be able to, for the new forager, mm-hmm. to be able to make sure that the product that they're finding, that they're picking, that they think is something, is really safe. And you have a website and a group of people supporting that website who can be engaged by people who need that kind of help.
Yeah, and we have a wild hemlock in this area.
Yeah, and what's and the website is Tama?
The website is meadowsandmore.com. If people still, we do also, the ebook version of the book has a 62 additional field photos. So if people, you know, because sometimes people want to see what does it look like when it's growing in the field outdoors. So we have outdoor shots too. But if you're still nervous, you can post a photo. We have a sort of service, a public service on the website that is a plant ID form. And field botanists and naturalists moderate that. So you can post a photo and you will get a response. Sometimes people forget to post the photo and they come back and say, oh, that's a very nice question, but we do need the photo. It's very interesting. And you can see what other people have been posting, too. So I hope that will encourage people to try a little bit.
I think you're onto a great thing here. We're so glad that you got away from Wall Street just a little bit. And somehow I think we have the feeling that what you're doing is a great deal more useful for the planet than what
it's very satisfying, I should say. Yes.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Tama. We enjoyed talking to you very much, and I'm sure you'll keep in touch. I expect that this will not be the only book you will contribute, so I hope you'll come back to us again when you have something more you'd like to talk to our audience about.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tama.
Okay.
And we'll be back with the final segment right after this break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, we introduce you to many people that you enjoy, but we also introduce you to some products that you might enjoy. Next up is one of those very special Boat Street pickles. One of the most pleasant things that we've been eating lately, anything we can put together with Boat Street pickles. We're going to be talking to the creator of these wonderful things, Renee Erickson. You have a cafe called Boat Street Cafe in Seattle, and it's been in business for a while, and about 4 years ago you started making these pickles because your customers wanted to take them home, right?
Correct, yes.
Where do you come from? What is your background?
I'm a Seattle native, So I grew up on the east side of Lake Washington, and I grew up in a town called Woodinville, which has sort of become famous for wine in Washington. But I just grew up here and ended up in the food business sort of randomly. I was an artist and started working in restaurants and got to travel a lot and fell in love with food when I was in Italy. So eventually I ended up buying the Boat Street, and now I'm still there.
Now, I understand that the Boat Street Cafe is a well-recognized restaurant, although it's a bit obscurely located, is that correct?
It's true, yes.
But I don't know anything much more about it. It's supposed to be very charming, right?
Correct, yes. We've been in two locations. First location was also kind of obscure and in an odd sort of situation. It was surrounded by boat marines, like shops, and along the cut in Seattle. And when we were forced to move, we were trying to maintain that kind of character, so we took some time and ended up finding a place that was also near the water but downtown and is also uniquely oddly located and in a building that has a lot of old charm, and we are just sort of concerned about trying to maintain the authenticity of the original one. So it is curiously located, but it kind of transports you as well. You have to walk down a ramp and you kind of turn this corner and there's this big courtyard and staircase and patio, and yeah, it's like seeing it first, but then it makes sense once you're there.
Well, now, Renee, you said you fell in love with cooking in Italy, which is not hard to do. We just got back from our umpteenth trip to Italy and had a wonderful time. I understand that the cooking at the Boat Street is more Provençal than Italian.
It's true. I was an artist and got to stay in Rome, and I think specifically when I say I fell in love with food, I fell in love with the type of cooking that exists. Well, it's starting to exist here, thankfully, now, but historically in Europe, everyone was there's tradition and kind of a daily nature to what they wanted to eat or make and shop for, and I didn't grow up with that. Like, we have, you know, big supermarkets and you get everything everywhere, and there wasn't like a culture around unique shops that sold specialty foods and meats and seafood and fromageries and everything. So I think after more travel, I then discovered my kind of affinity toward French cooking and just the love of that part of Europe that I still today, like,
no,
can't
I,
wait to come
I,
back
I
to.
Can picture, I can remember the last time we were on Provence sitting having dinner at a restaurant. I think we might have, I don't think we were sitting outside, but we were on the slopes of the mountain that, not Monet, who was the guy who painted that mountain all the time? He painted it 150 times and he never
Cezanne.
Could get it right. Cezanne.
Cezanne?
Yeah, there's a mountain that he painted in all kinds of light conditions and he said he never got it right.
Right.
So I'm picturing that you can picture yourself in the same kind of setting, but you decided to bring it back to Seattle after all.
Yeah, well, it is sort of gray here, so it's nice to have some transporting ideas in your head in the middle of winter when it's, you know, low cloud cover and all you want to do is...
Such a coterie of food people there. I mean, half the people we interviewed turn out to be in Seattle.
Seattle, we're lucky,
Vermont.
Yeah.
Well, all my Twitter buddies are...
Well, Thierry Retro, you like.
Of course.
Tom Douglas, you like.
Yeah.
Lots of people.
The herb farm guy.
Well, he's
Jerry,
not,
yeah.
Well, he's not there anymore, I guess, right?
No.
He's somewhere else.
He has Poppy now.
Okay, so he has another restaurant in Seattle?
Uh-huh, yeah. It's called Poppy. It's up on Capitol Hill.
Oh, great.
And it's lovely.
And you've got Foragers there. You've got our Taylor Fish people with John Rowley. I mean, it's a wonderful group.
I was lucky to come from a place that has, I think what makes it so special is the situation to the Sound, which is this protected, beautiful place where you can get pretty much, I think, some of the best seafood in the world. And then we're so close to the mountains, and we just have this really great collection of climate that allows for things to kind of grow magically here. I mean, we're not, you know, we're certainly not California with the cliff and everything, but we have our own kind of version of that. And I think the people that live here are just super creative and really passionate about food and thrilled to be here. So
well, now let's focus in on the pickles themselves, because it's interesting. They're all made out.
Can I just say they're delicious?
Well, of course you can.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just hoping you might let me say something.
Yeah, I'll let you say something as long as I get in that. They're really delicious.
I'm about to hang up my microphone altogether. You can do the rest of the interview yourself. You won't let me say a word.
You can talk, Rabbit. Talk now.
So you started inventing these pickles quite a few years ago in the restaurant, I guess, Renee, if I'm picturing correctly.
Yes, it's correct. We have, well, it's creatively called the pickle plate, which is a dish on the menu, and it basically was things that seasonally we were getting that we would then pickle and use in dishes, as well as just kind of showcasing them all individually as pickles. And so it would be anywhere from 8 to 10 different things that we would compose, and they're all pickled separately, and then they all get placed on a plate, kind of piled. And they were made, the plums were the original ones, and that was something, seriously, just a thing that I had had in France, where it was just this delicious sour pickled plum that was served with a, you know, like traditional pâté, and I just hadn't had anything that was like that, and thought it was really appropriate to cooking for me, because I really love sour foods or acids. And I think especially when you're cooking in a restaurant, and particularly cooking French food, there's lots of fats and rich decadent flavors. And I think, you know, to balance that with something that has these nice tartness to it, I think was something that I was looking for. And yeah, and then I just sort of got the bug and started pickling literally everything. And it was, you know, some of them were great, some of them were really odd, but we've kind of collected our favorites. And, you know, now we pickle rhubarb, and we're pickling fiddlehead ferns right now, and sea beans.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. So
what are those like? Oh, those would be good.
They're delicious. They're, fiddleheads are kind of like a very earthy asparagus in a way, and they're just lovely to look at too, so it's just a fun thing to be able to do. And I think when you asked about why pickling has become popular, I think for me, it's just exactly what you do it for, is to preserve something so that you get to have it longer than it is just fresh. And for us to be able to stock up, you know, like we probably do maybe like a 10-gallon bucket of fiddleheads, so that, you know, we can have them all summer long into the fall, rather, you know, just, we don't jar up our pickles that we use in the restaurant, because we're not going to keep them that long. And
what do you sell? I mean, do you sell these things you're playing? Because
we don't sell the fiddleheads. We just sell the four right now. Part of the problem is I think a lot of times they aren't as sturdy, or at this point, like to hand pack a lot of things, price up to a place where no one would really buy them.
I don't know.
So,
I found out people are scooping up this $14 a pint Jenny's ice cream.
Well, I think maybe pickles aren't quite as well loved yet as ice cream, sadly. But we have some plans for some other varieties that we're going to work on. We're going to try to do some fennel, and I actually really would like to do watermelon. So we're working on some other options for things, which is exciting. So we're into that. But, you know, in the packet, you know, like when you're packing something for shelf stable, it becomes a much kind of slower process than just selling it, you know, out of the restaurant.
Where can people get these? We got ours because you shipped them to us. Is most of the shopping either at the restaurant or online?
So we sell them all over the country, and most in like specialty grocery stores.
Oh, okay, so you've got real volume.
Yeah, we're doing really well. I mean, it's definitely been slow going. I think for us, we started out packing all the pickles ourselves in the restaurant, which was pretty much the only way I think we could have really started. But then we got to a place, you know, where we didn't have the capacity to make as much as we could there. So we've moved our production now. We're in the Willamette Valley, and we go down there once a month and make pickles, basically in a facility where we can use like larger kitchen equipment and things. So that's been hugely helpful to us to be able to keep up with demand. And we're still growing. We're still a kind of small production company, but for us to be able to keep up, we definitely couldn't do it anymore in the restaurant. So
right now, there is a special website, right, for the pickle company called Boat Street Pickles, www.boatstreetpickles.com. The restaurant, in case people are actually in Seattle, as we plan to be, hopefully, we're hoping to come to some kind of sustainable chefs conference going on in, I think it's in September.
In the fall, yeah.
So we're hoping to come to that. Is there a store locator for the pickles on Boat Street Pickles?
Yeah, there is a store locator. And then, yeah, the restaurant is just, we do sell them in the restaurant if you're in Seattle as well. Most grocery stores locally carry them, as well as lots of specialty cheese stores and De Laurentiis, places like that sell a lot of cheese and charcuterie and things.
Great success with this, because I think that you've got a hot product here.
Oh, thank you so much.
And
we love them.
You were the recipient of the Silver Sophie, which is...
We were, for the fig.
Keep going.
Thank you.
Yes, and hopefully we'll see you when we're in Seattle.
Yeah, I'll be here. I'm planning on attending, so I'll see you in September.
Great.
Thank you so much for joining us, Renee.
Thank you.
Bye.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
And there you have it. That's all for On the Menu Radio for another week. We'll look forward to having you join us same time, same place next week. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.